Coming up is the news.
India registers a single-day record of nearly 3,800 deaths from the coronavirus and over 380,000 new cases. And people take to the streets in the Colombian capital for the seventh consecutive day, demanding social reforms as well as an end to police violence. Hello and welcome, everybody. Our top story for this half hour: Israeli forces arrest several Palestinians in clashes in occupied East Jerusalem. Al-Quds, the arrests were made as Palestinians were protesting the Israelis' ongoing effort to forcefully evict them from their homes in Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. An Israeli court on Sunday ruled that over a dozen Palestinian families must leave their homes by Saturday, despite having lived there for generations. Palestinians see the move as part of Israel's land grab policy to expand its settlements and change the geographic character of Jerusalem, Al-Quds. Meanwhile, the military wing of Palestinian resistance movement Hamas warned Tel Aviv against any more threats and attacks against the residents of the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. Our correspondent Mona Kandil says Israeli settlers claim the land in Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood in occupied East Jerusalem, Al-Quds, belongs to them, but they have no proof and documents whatsoever to prove their claim.
A few years ago, Israeli settlers and right-wing groups filed a lawsuit against the families in Sheikh Jarrah, claiming that they own the land just before 1948. However, they don't have any documents to prove their ownership of the land. In 2007, some families were forced to leave their homes in Sheikh Jarrah. On Sunday, there was a trial and a hearing for seven Palestinian families. However, the court postponed the last saying till Thursday, saying that they hope the Palestinians and the settlers reach an agreement. However, the Palestinian families refused any suggestions from the Israeli settler groups or the Israeli regime, insisting that these are their homes and that the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood is a Palestinian Arab neighborhood and they will not leave it in any way. So that's why demonstrations continue to take place, protests every night with the number of settlers coming to the area and harassing the Palestinians there, clashing with them, the Israeli police, as well attacking Palestinians there in order to protect the settlers.
Iran's President Hassan Rouhani says all Israeli plots against the Islamic Republic have failed over the past 3 years. Rouhani said Israel sought to topple Iran's Islamic Revolution through the U.S. maximum pressure campaign in 3 months. The president said, however, the resistance of the Iranian nation turned the Zionist regime's plot into a failure. He pointed that Israel also did its utmost to drive a wedge between Iran and regional nations. Rouhani said Tel Aviv's efforts to pit Iran and its Arab neighbors against each other have reached nowhere. The Iranian president further referred to Israel's decades of occupation, saying Palestinian territories will be eventually liberated. The comments come ahead of the International Quds Day that will be marked on Friday with pro-Palestinian rallies around the world. Syrian media say air defense systems have intercepted Israeli missiles over Latakia and Hama provinces. We were earlier joined by our correspondent in Damascus, Muhammad Ali, to get more on the latest Israeli attack on Syria.
So loud explosions were heard by the residents of the cities of Latakia and Tartus after midnight local time here in Syria, in what turned out to be Syrian air defense is responding to an Israeli attack on Latakia countryside in particular, and also areas west of Hama city like Musiaf. What happened was that there was an Israeli attack, one of the areas that was targeted was a civilian area. It was actually an industrial area. It was a factory for plastic industries in Latakia countryside in an area called Ra'is Shamra, Fire broke out as a result, but firefighters were able to extinguish the fire. According to the governor of Latakia, the Israeli attack on that industrial area in Latakia countryside led to the killing of one Syrian civilian and the injury of six others.
The United States says a group of seven industrialized nations has vowed to end the war in Syria. Earlier, we discussed the issue in our news review program. Let's take a listen. Now, Washington says a group of seven industrialized nations has pledged to end the decade-long war in Syria. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said G7 members reaffirmed their commitment to a political solution to the conflict, adding that the group will reauthorize a U.N. cross-border aid mechanism, which allows for delivery of aid to Syrians without the permission of the central government. Blinken said the G7 will continue working to advance all aspects of a Security Council resolution, which calls for a ceasefire and political settlement to the conflict in Syria. U.S. is widely accused of violating Syrian sovereignty with its military presence. Washington has refused to withdraw its forces from the war-torn country and has openly backed anti-Damascus militants. And now joining us for the program is Tony Gosling, investigative journalist joining us from Bristol, and Edward Corgan, international lawyer and commentator joining us out of Ontario. Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you both to the program. I guess we'll start there with you, Tony. Hope you're safe and doing well out there. Your thoughts on these kind of these mixed messages. You hear, voices out of Washington, especially Secretary of State Antony Blinken, saying we want to put an end to this thing, but then actions on the ground and the fact that they're still present in the country and choking it off with the Caesar Act is not really doing anything for the future of Syria, is it?
Well, I think the big, the hypocrisy of this is that the G7 haven't really announced that the G7 are pledging to end the Syrian war. What's happened is the Russians have ended the Syria war by backing the government, elected government of President Assad, in what was a proxy war, which NATO were paying for all these mercenaries to destroy the country, very much like they successfully did over in Libya. And this is really the hypocrisy that you see at these sorts of G7 meetings, is that they are having to face this reality, but they're trying to pretend that it's something that they wanted. It's the last thing in the world they wanted. On the road to Damascus, which was the road they wanted the mercenaries to walk and to fire their way along, they wanted to take Damascus. They failed to do that. And this is them having to finally admit, but trying to dress it up with some PR spin to make out that it's a good thing. The Russians have done this. And the reason for that is because if NATO and the Western countries had succeeded in Syria in undermining and overturning the government through their proxy armies and their mercenaries, the Islamists that they've been funding ever since Operation Cyclone in Afghanistan in the 1980s, which the CIA all funded, then the Russians would have lost their base in Syria, in the Mediterranean, and they have been forced to back into the Black Sea by the Western powers. And the Russians realised that that could be decisive in any future conflict. So that's what's really happened here.
Thank you there, Tony. And Edward, I'd like to welcome you to the program. Your initial thoughts on this?
Well, I pretty much agree with the other commentator. The whole war in Syria, it's not a civil war. It was more or less an invasion through proxies and, funded by the Saudis, the United Arab Emirates, Qatar for a period of time. And, of course, the Americans, the British, the French, and the Israelis all were paying for these soldiers. And it was, there was no civil war in Syria. It really is a foreign invasion. But the Western powers who tried to effect regime change in Syria, like they did in Libya, like they did in Iraq, like they did in Afghanistan, failed because the Russians did put their foot down and were going to support their base at Tartarus on the Mediterranean. And of course, it's very dangerous. The West was saying, we're fighting Islamic extremists, except the Islamic extremists were in fact funded, trained, and supported by the West. the Americans did more bombing of Syrian troops than they ever did of Daesh. And when the Daesh was stealing, you know, convoys full of oil from Syria and sending them into Turkey, the Americans were ordered the pilots were ordered not to attack that. It wasn't until the Russians started attacking the convoys that was shut down. But we look at not what the Americans and their allies were saying, but what they were doing. They were, you know, funding and training these Islamic extremists, and at the same time say we're going in there to try to prevent the Islamic extremists from taking over. But it was all an attempt to destroy the Syrian national government that was inclusive and was quite stable, actually.
And Edward, I'm glad you alluded to that, because the G7 are saying that we are committed to a political resolution of the conflict in Syria, and we're committed to ending the Syrian conflict. And so my question back to you, with everything you just said, how does that make sense? There's no respect for the government in Damascus. All the G7, along with a few of their allies, are still trying to topple the government there in Damascus. So where's the political resolution that they're seeking?
Well, it's a face-saving measure. And it's also, I think, an attempt to, they're still trying to effect regime change. You know, they talk about Syria being, you know, a dictatorship. But the fact is that there's an election went on. Assad won over 70% of the vote. And there is, you know, not a perfect democracy, but a democracy in Syria that certainly is a lot better than the one in Israel or Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, which are, of course, supported by the same, you know, gang of seven, if you want to call them that. But they're still hoping, you know, they're saying that we can send aid into areas that are outside of the control of the central government. And, you know, probably close to 90% of Syria is under control of the Damascus government, which is internationally recognized as a legitimate government, except by people who don't like it. And, you know, you have, you know, they're still trying to maybe break up Syria, which I think was the original plan, and, of course, destroy the country. They have destroyed much of the country. But the opposition to the Damascus regime has been crushed. They have lost the war, but there's still American troops illegally in Syria. They're still looting oil. They're still stealing grain and wheat and other products.
Gentlemen, thank you both for joining us on the program. Tony Gosling, investigative journalist there, joining us out of Bristol, and Edward Corgier, international lawyer and commentator, joining us from Ontario. That's a wrap for the segment of News Review program. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now. Welcome back. India registers a new record in its daily coronavirus deaths, reporting 3,780 fatalities in the past 24 hours. The health ministry also reported more than 382,000 new cases in the same period. For nearly the past 2 weeks, India has posted more than 300,000 cases every day. It became the second country in the world to pass the grim milestone of 20 million total infections after the U.S. The deadly wave of the virus has overwhelmed India's resources, including its medical supplies and hospitals.
What about me at present?
Our hospital now has about 300 beds, and more than 200 of them have been used to treat patients. But we are not able to receive more of them with the remaining beds, mainly because we're facing an acute shortage of oxygen supplies. The provision of oxygen by our supplier just can't meet our needs.
The alarming rise in cases and deaths has forced shutdowns and restrictions on travel from the country, but the Indian government is reluctant to impose a complete national lockdown due to its economic fallout. The World Health Organization has called on India to strengthen its response to the pandemic. It says continued transmissions and lack of compliance are the major factors contributing to the current crisis there. Elsewhere, the lawmakers in the European Union have demanded greater support for the bloc's tourism and aviation industries. Both sectors have been severely affected by the COVID-19 pandemic. Concern is mounting that the EU is entering a deep long-term recession. Jerome Hughes reports from Brussels.
It is estimated that prior to the pandemic, 27 million people worked in the EU's hospitality sector. Small to medium-sized firms are described as the backbone of the 27-nation bloc's finances. The Eurozone economy has contracted further and is now in a so-called double-dip recession. Citizens in Brussels have been sharing their thoughts.
It's impossible to stop everything, you know? The corona is there, the economy is dead.
Like waitresses or waiters, and they lost their jobs, so they are in a bad condition now.
Me too. Like, I work, and my work is impact of the coronavirus.
It's very difficult to have hope because we don't know how it's going on, and we don't know what the future is made.
More and more workers lost their jobs, like restaurants.
Members of the European Parliament say the EU's aviation and tourism industries need emergency assistance.
Businesses in hospitality sector are on their knees. They need not just financial support, but also longer-term measures to restart and recover. The tourism may never be the same.
Lawmakers say the EU's vaccination rollout is too slow. Just 10% of the population have been fully vaccinated. They are also highly critical over a lack of joined-up thinking when it comes to implementing COVID-19 restrictions. Governments were supposed to submit applications to the European Commission for recovery funding by last Friday. So far, just 14 of the 27 have done so. There is concern that the process lacks transparency.
We have encouraged all member states to make the submitted plans to the Commission public. But again, it's up to the member states to decide what they wish to publish.
An unprecedented social crisis might be on the horizon for the EU. It's possible the millions of jobs that have been lost so far only represent the tip of the iceberg. Several studies have concluded that up to one quarter of small to medium-sized businesses in the EU will go under once restrictions are lifted and government supports are taken away. These are firms that employ 250 people or less. Clearly, then, we're talking about huge numbers. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
In Colombia, people have again taken to the streets to denounce violence against anti-government protesters. The protesters marched in Bogota, blocking public transport and traffic. Similar rallies were held in Cali, where protesters paid tribute to the people killed during the anti-government demonstrations. The rallies marked the seventh day in protests in the country. They started last Wednesday against a now-canceled tax reform plan. However, they morphed into broader anti-government protests following a violent police crackdown on people that killed 19 and injured over 800. They now call for social reforms as well as an end to police violence.
We do not want more deaths. We do not want to bleed to death, and we reject the acts of violence that the Colombian state has been taking against us.
Colombia's Minister of Defense, Diego Molano, has blamed the violence on criminal groups. They say groups saying that they have given orders to shoot police officers. President Ivan Duque has once again called for national dialogue after days of unrest. The violence in the country has drawn international criticism. The UN has condemned the excessive use of force during the protests, calling for calm. And that's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
the limelight.
The Biden administration's weapons sales to the UAE is a disastrous move. It puts the U.S. squarely on the side of a serial human rights abuser and inflames a region already awash with way too many weapons. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written jointly by Media Benjamin and Ariel Gold, anti-war activists. This article is published under the heading, Why is Biden selling weapons to a country that helped make Yemen a hell hole? Stay tuned for more. The Biden administration's recent announcement giving a green light to a massive $23 billion weapons sales to the United Arab Emirates makes a mockery of its commitment to put human rights at the forefront of its foreign policy. The Emirates' disastrous roles in Yemen and Libya, along with its vicious human rights record at home, should disqualify it from acquiring advanced weapons. The deal was negotiated under the Trump administration and came to light less than a week after Donald Trump announced the normalization of relations between the Zionist regime and the UAE, known as the Abraham Accords. While the public was diverted with Trump's supposedly brilliant peace initiative, the secret clause that sweetened the deal was leaked. The U.S. would sell billions of dollars of weapons to the Persian Gulf state, 50 F-35 fighter jets, 18 Reaper drones, and various missiles, bombs, and munitions. The UAE and the Zionist regime have never been at war and had maintained unofficial ties for years, but the peace accord allowed the Trump administration to circumvent a policy that requires the United States to guarantee the Israeli regime's military superiority in the region. The Zionist regime's Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu initially feigned outrage that another West Asian country besides the regime would possess the high-tech F-35, but it was soon revealed that the Prime Minister had been in the know from the start and had approved the deal with his own caveat. The Israeli regime would get additional U.S. weapons to balance those going to the UAE. Congressional opponents of the arms deal responded by introducing a bipartisan resolution of disapproval to block the sale. Surprisingly, hawkish Senator Bob Menendez, chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, led the resolution with Senators Chris Murphy and Ron Paul. They cited concerns about the timing as a rushed end run around Congress, the UAE's troubling involvement in Yemen and Libya. Though their legislation was voted down when Joe Biden came into office, the State Department put this sale, as well as a weapons deal Trump had negotiated with Saudi Arabia, on hold. Human rights groups were encouraged that the Biden review might lead to a quashing of the deal, but apparently, geopolitical pressures, the hawks in the administration, and pressure from the weapons lobby have won the day. The companies that stand to gain hefty profits from this sale include Lockheed Martin, Raytheon, General Atomics, and Northrop Grumman. Lockheed Martin will get $10.4 billion selling 50 of its F-35s. According to the New York Times, Raytheon, the biggest supplier of the bombs, lobbied the Trump administration for the deal. Trump's Secretary of Defense Mike Esper was a lobbyist for Raytheon, and Biden's Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin is a former Raytheon board member. The UAE's role in Yemen should have been enough to quash the deal. For the past 6 years, the U.S.-supported coalition led by Saudi Arabia has been waging a war in Yemen so brutal that, according to David Beasley, executive director of the World Food Program, this war-torn nation is hell on earth, where one Yemeni child dies every 75 seconds. In 2017, Human Rights Watch and Associated Press accused the UAE of operating secret prisons in Yemen where prisoners were subjected to horrific forms of torture. Former inmates described cramped conditions covered in feces, being beaten, sexually assaulted, and trussed up on a grill. "We could hear the screams," said a former detainee held for 6 months at the Ryan Airport. "The entire place is gripped by fear. Almost everyone is sick. The rest are near death. Anyone who complains heads directly to the torture chamber," said one former detainee. In addition to its direct involvement, the UAE supported local proxies, around 90,000 fighters, providing them with direct training, capacity building, logistic assistance, and salaries. It also brought in mercenaries from as far away as Colombia, and weapons sold to the UAE ended up in the hands of Al-Qaeda terrorists inside Yemen. Complaints have been filed in the courts in the UK and the US, alleging that UAE mercenaries in Yemen committed human rights abuses and war crimes. They also allege that the UAE joined the Saudis in enforcing a naval blockade that has kept fuel, food, and medicines from people in need, committing over 30 fighter jets to carry out airstrikes and naval ships to enforce the coalition's blockade. Anxious to get out of a losing war that has been so bad for its image, the Emirates held a ceremony on February 9, 2020, to mark the end of their involvement in the Yemeni war, moving from a military-first strategy to a peace-first strategy. But humanitarian groups on the ground tell us that the UAE maintains a presence in Saqqarah, Mokalla, and a small presence in Yemen. In addition, it offers financial and military support to a variety of armed groups and political movements that have had a destabilizing influence throughout the country, particularly in the south. Another strike against the sale is that it is fueling the West Asia arms race. While the UAE is set to become the first Arab state to acquire F-35s, it will not be the last. Qatar has already asked to purchase them, and Saudi Arabia will likely follow. The Israeli regime is expecting additional arms beyond the $3.8 billion they already receive annually from the U.S. in military assistance. A final reason is to oppose the deal is the UAE domestic situation. Prince Mohammed bin Zayed is a shrewd West Asian dictator who uses his country's military and financial resources to thwart moves toward democracy and respect for human rights under the guise of fighting terrorism. The UAE restricts freedom of expression and silences dissent. According to Amnesty International, in 2020, despite the COVID-19 pandemic, the UAE continued to detain dozens of prisoners of conscience, including prominent human rights defender Ahmed Mansour. The government keeps opponents under arbitrary detention, and a number of prisoners remain incarcerated despite having completed their sentences. On April 15, 2021, a cross-party coalition of European parliamentarians condemned the systematic crackdown on freedom of speech and expression and called for the release of all prisoners of conscience and an end to torture and ill treatment of these prisoners and the protection of prisoners' families from collective punishment. Another group subject to all kinds of abuses are the millions of migrants who work in Emirates under the kafala system, a type of visa sponsorship system which deprives workers of basic rights. Faced with domestic crises that include a pandemic, a battered economy, and exploding racial tensions, President Biden understands the need to focus his attention on domestic issues and wind down U.S. military entanglements from the past two decades. His recent announcement that U.S. troops will leave Afghanistan by September 11, 2021 reflects this. A $23 billion weapons sales to the UAE is a disastrous move in the Biden administration. It puts the U.S. squarely on the side of a serial human rights abuser and inflames a region already awash with way too many weapons. A new round of legislation by Senators Menendez and Feinstein is being introduced to put checks on the sale of F-35s, but it is the entire sale that must be questioned. If Biden refuses to put domestic and human rights concerns ahead of the profits of weapons manufacturers, then Congress must step and pass legislation to stop it.
The debate.
Hello and a warm welcome to the debate. I'm Behruz Najafi. Seeing the beatings, vandalism, and detentions in Colombia these days, human rights groups have condemned the police's heavy-handed tactics against rallyers. It's said that 19 civilians have lost their lives and over 800 people have been wounded. The rallies are still underway, despite the government's announcement of reviewing a tax reform package that has sparked the protests. It seems that the demonstrations are not going to stop as people and unions are raising more demands. So what's next in Colombia? Will the Duque administration stop the crackdown and instead heed the people's demands? Okay, to discuss those questions, I'm joined by our guests in tonight's debate. Here we'll have journalists with the Behind the Headlines, Dan Cohen, who's joining us out of Washington, D.C., and also journalist and political analyst, Ali Vargas from Cochabamba in Bolivia. Good to have you both on the show. Let's go to Dan first. The concession by Duque's government, Dan, to backpedal on a proposed tax reform has done little to calm the protesters' anger. Why is that?
Well, Duque's announcement was little more than an attempt to trick the population into stopping the protests. When Duque announced that he would withdraw it, he also said that he would announce another proposal in the next few days, and that it was absolutely necessary. And this trick failed. The protests have only grown, and the demands have continued to add up, because Colombia is a country in absolute crisis, where 43% of the population is in poverty and 15% is in extreme poverty, and the government is attempting to force these tax reforms throat of the public, and it's being rejected.
Okay, Ali, popular anger goes beyond the tax reform, and protesters are demanding much more than the withdrawal of the tax reforms only. So what are the other things that the protesters ask them for?
Well, Colombia is going through a very similar crisis to another South American country, Peru, and that is that Colombia historically and currently, of course, has a free market economic model that delivered growth for the 1% and crumbs for the vast majority of people. And sort of a mix of propaganda, repression has managed to keep sort of social unrest at bay, or at least repress it when it does come out. However, the pandemic has seen that social setup, that system, really crumble, because, and I think the tax reform that they're trying to push through is a symbol of that, because with the pandemic and with the lockdown having destroyed the country's tax base as businesses close down, people fall out of formal employment. So their solution, now that the government doesn't have enough revenue, is to tax the general population, raise taxes on the general population. Mm-hmm. And they have to do this because Colombia is a country that doesn't have big state industries that can provide it with revenue to have the funds that it needs to satisfy basic demands of ordinary people, particularly at a time like this. So we've seen people lose faith in the system that Colombia has had for decades under, and has maintained with an iron fist. So people's demands are against inequality, are against the narco violence that emanates from the states and from pro-state paramilitary groups. That's been a tactic that used to repress social protests for a long time, and people finally had enough. So it's a general uprising. It's not about one policy. This policy was, of course, the trigger for the reasons I explained, but this is a much wider rebellion.
Okay. Now, Dan, as you may know, Colombia is one of the countries with the largest debts in the world, and how is this affecting its domestic politics and the pressure that the government is facing in order to balance its finances?
Well, there's no doubt that the Colombian government is beholden to international capital and the neoliberal economic system. And this tax reform is essentially to please international capital. So investors see Colombia as a sort of stable market. Now, that stability comes at the price of stability and security for working class, for middle class, for poor people. This constant instability that Colombians suffer, well, the government has tried to kind of keep a lid on it, as Ali explained, and has been pretty successful for a long time. But attempting to force, this new tax reform, this increase in taxes on the country has backfired massively. And, I think the government is, it has no answer other than to use brute force to kill protesters. It's not even clear how many protesters have been killed at this point. I actually spoke to a journalist, Laura Sofia Mejia, about a press agency in Pereira, Colombia today, who told me that the highest levels of the government have given an order for the hospitals to not report the number of deaths and injuries. So it's only up to the journalists to go through the hospitals and the emergency rooms and count how many deaths there have been. So there's no real count, and I think it's safe to assume that it's much higher than the 19 or 20 that have been reported so far. So Colombia is in absolute crisis purely because of the financial system that its ruling class uses.
Now, let me ask you this. People have concerns about police violence and also human rights situations. So how serious are these concerns?
Well, it's extremely serious. Colombia is one of the most violent countries in the Americas. And the massacres that just taken place in the city of Cali is the 35th massacre of this year, of 2021. The vast majority of massacres that take place on a weekly basis in Colombia, on a more than weekly basis, predominantly take place in rural areas against union leaders, rural workers, leaders, indigenous leaders, ex-FARC combatants. So the violence has been ongoing and permanent. I mean, just last year, 2020, there was over 90 massacres. So, Colombia is looking on course to at least match the level of violence that the country saw last year. And it's something that's obviously not reported on in international media in any systematic way. And even now, we see the same thing. We see Latin America correspondents for the big newspapers be completely silent on this issue, including the South America bureau chief for the Wall Street Journal, someone who lives in Colombia and has not written any articles about it. He hasn't even posted anything on Twitter about it, something that's taking place in his own country, because this is something that's severely embarrassing for a key US ally. And Colombia is a key US ally for a number of reasons, as the largest number of US military bases in the region in South America. And it's a key player in destabilizing other countries, destabilizing, for example, Venezuela, reinforcing the US attacks on Venezuela. So I think these are all things that we have to take together. And when, you know, the United States is not going to let one of their key allies go quietly. I think that while we have silence at the moment, we may see a propaganda machine kicking in to try and defend the current government and its human rights violations.
Dan, let's now take a look at Duque's presidency and his performance. Critics are saying that his presidency is marked by incompetence, and also some others are saying that also neglecting the voices of dissent. How would you size up his performance as president?
I think those are very fair opinions of the Duque government. I mean, since day one, he's been unpopular, incompetent, as you said, and basically a puppet of the kingmaker politician in Colombia, the former president, Álvaro Uribe, who is, the U.S. has known for many years, is essentially a drug trafficker. And actually, Duque's presidency was bought and paid for by drug traffickers themselves. There was a major scandal that was completely ignored in the U.S. press, called Ñeñe Política, in which a powerful drug trafficker named Ñeñe Hernández was found to be buying votes for Iván Duque, and this was ordered by Álvaro Uribe, the former president and top U.S. ally. So it's more than incompetence. This is a complete narco state. It's been that way for decades, and under the presidency of first Álvaro Uribe and now Iván Duque, the power of the drug trafficking cartels, as well as the below board and the above board international cartels, have complete power, and so they're not going to give that up without an extreme bloodbath, and that's what we're seeing today.
Now, Ollie, let's take a look back. I want you to please bring us up to speed about the developments that Colombia has experienced after the peace deal in 2016, and you know that ended 50 years of fighting between the FARC rebel group and the government. So what is the security situation like in the country 5 years after this deal?
Yeah, that's right. The 2016 peace accords ended the longest civil war in human history. But I think for a lot of people, that civil war is still ongoing. Now, as I mentioned earlier, there's massacres on a, 2 to 3 massacres every week in Colombia, predominantly in rural areas where there used to be FARC insurgencies. And even though the FARC, now they are called the Communist Party, even though they handed in their weapons, they agreed to relinquish the territory they held, and they agreed to enter formal politics as a peaceful political group committed to an electoral path towards social change that they demand. Despite all of those steps taken by one side of those who signed the peace deal, the FARC, the armed insurgency, that hasn't been respected by the state nor the paramilitary groups that often fight alongside them. So that state, the military, these paramilitary groups, they continue to assassinate ex-FARC combatants, people who handed in their weapons, and people whose names are on those 2016 peace accords. So for those people, for the hundreds of people who signed that peace treaty but have since been killed in that time, the civil war certainly didn't end for them. And of course, there's a wider war against the population. The wider population is being waged now. Now that we have blood rain through the streets of urban areas, normally restricted to the rural areas of the country. So it's all coming to a crisis point, and precisely because of the economic issue that I mentioned at the beginning. So countries, for example, like Bolivia, that have large nationalized industries that provide most of the government revenue that the state uses to pay for its functions, Colombia doesn't have that. Colombia has a free market model. So when the tax base collapses during lockdown, if they don't have big state assets like countries like Bolivia have. So it's a problem of a wider economic free market model that wasn't built to sustain the sorts of blows that the pandemic has dealt the country. And it's the same immediate cause of the internal political crisis in Peru. The system that was raised and that shown up as an example of democratic neoliberalism crumpled upon impact when the pandemic hit, and the state and the free market model was exposed to something that wasn't able to take its blows, wasn't able to provide for ordinary people that suffered economically, and has left the state without the resources to rebuild the economy.
Dan, as you know, protesters are also angry at the lack of a social safety net during the pandemic. So what has been the impact of the pandemic on Colombia's economy, and how would you evaluate the government's response to the pandemic's economic and social impacts?
Well, even prior to the pandemic, Colombia was in a terrible situation financially with a large swaths of the country in poverty and also in extreme poverty. And as Ollie explained so clearly, the pandemic has only exacerbated these problems. As I said before, the poverty is now at 43% of the country. It's nearly half of the people are impoverished, and 15% are in extreme poverty. People are not able to buy basic foods. They don't have their basic needs met. They can't eat. They can't buy medicine. So this is come to a breaking point now, and the pandemic has been completely mismanaged in the most extreme way. I see New York Times articles criticizing Venezuela for its handling of the pandemic when Colombia has been multitudes worse. There are millions and millions of cases of COVID-19 in Colombia, and that's never really touched on in mainstream media in the U.S. It's always about Venezuela, as with all other issues. So Colombia has been, mismanaged is an understatement. It's been so severe. It has made this kind of reckoning inevitable. And, sadly, now the government, after mismanaging the economy and the pandemic in such a terrible way, has now decided that it will murder basically anyone who rises up against it.
Ollie, the way that the government has handled the protests has drawn the ire of both the Colombian people and the international community and rights organizations. They're all calling for an end to this crackdown. And some believe that police reform is a must. Let's have your opinion on that.
Well, the entire international community hasn't come together to condemn this sort of violence. The notable people who have been notably silent include the Organization of American States and their secretary, Luis Almagro, someone who holds conferences, events on an almost weekly basis about Venezuela or Nicaragua or some other country. There's been silence from the United States, of course. The United States wasn't so silent when Bolivia arrested former dictator Henry Añez, but they have been a lot more silent when it comes to the executions in the streets of the urban Colombia. Also notable, as I mentioned earlier, notable in their silence has been the international media. Western correspondents working for outlets such as the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, have also been extremely silent about what's going on. So those, it's from those sectors, the sorts of sectors that the Colombian middle and upper class depend on for their own power, it's those sectors that have been silent about this and have refused to join the chorus of condemnation about what's going on in Colombia. So I think it'll be interesting to see how this develops, because the protests are not going away. The anger that people have is about structural reasons, so I don't think one move or another policy change is going to quell that. So if we see more repression, it'll be interesting to see if more international activists decide to express solidarity with the Colombian people who are living an a moment of extreme authoritarianism right across the country, with cities completely militarized and the ongoing violence in the country's rural areas.
Now, Dan, the government insists that the tax reform is needed to stabilize the country already ravaged by the pandemic, but middle-class people are complaining that the reform pressures them and favors the rich only. Let's have your comment.
Well, the government has really put itself in a difficult position because it's completely beholden to international capital. And so it's in quite a bit of debt. And so in order to keep international capital investors happy, it essentially does have to do this. And so the government has just put itself in this position where it's essentially has to force this tax reform down the throats of the Colombian people, and the Colombian people simply can't take it. The poverty is already too extreme. They're asking far too much. A 19% increase, I believe, on public transportation. It's just too much for people, and so now it's playing out in the streets where it's this contradiction it's one. These are just two incompatible forces, and so unless the government changes its policy or finds another way to satisfy these investors, then it's hard to see how this resolves. So, okay.
All right, Ali, what about the U.S.? It was mentioned that U.S. Is an ally. So there have been no reaction regarding all this crackdown and people's demands and the government's heavy-handed tactics against them.
No, and particularly people like Secretary of State Antony Blinken, which is someone who's normally so quick to condemn Latin American countries who don't toe the line of the U.S. Yeah, as I said earlier, there has been a general silence from the most powerful sectors that helped prop up the current Colombian regime. And Colombia is a country as well that produces well over 90% of the cocaine that reaches the United States, Peru producing most of the rest. And yet we see communiques all the time on a monthly basis from Secretary of State Antony Blinken and from the institution.
Looks like we have a problem with that. One quick question, Dan. What's the way out of this situation in Colombia? Cabinet reshuffle, national dialogue, or what? 30 seconds, please.
Without the government fully withdrawing this tax proposal, there's no way that these protests will die down. As we said at the beginning of the segment, the demands have only added, and there are so many issues that have been piled on top of that the government is not only government, but intentionally basically attacked all sectors of the country. So it's really hard to see how Duque comes out of this, and we could even see the downfall of Duque.
Okay. All right, and then we'll come to the end of this debate show. Let me thank our guests. We had journalists from the Behind the Headlines, Dan Cohen from Washington, D.C., and journalist and political analyst Oli Vargas, who joined us from Cochabamba in Bolivia.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
Axel Djawadi talks about the various keys of life and has brought about this book to be a companion for the very famous Mafatih al-Jiran, where one is a tool or the keys for paradise, and this book, of course, are the keys of life.
The Keys of Life, a program designed to tell you that what Islam gives you will help get you home with joy and faithfulness. So, well, listen to
The keys of life.
The world is a very, very big house. Many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين.
My name is Sheikh Zaid Al Salami.
A few years ago, I started the course of wanting to commentate on a very important book that I believe is something that would be useful for everyone who reads it, and that is the book Mafatih Al Hayat, written by Ayatollah Al-Uzma Al-Sheikh Jawadi Amuli. Inshallah, I do hope that we are all benefiting from the important points that Ayatollah Jawadi Amuli is mentioning in this book, especially him having reached this very high stage of spirituality, him being a arif himself, him being someone who has surpassed all of these levels. This topic, especially when it comes to kin and relatives and family members and parents and cousins and uncles and aunties. And here we're talking about, in today's episode, we're talking about how are we able to be better to our family members. And it all comes down to life skills. It all comes down to life management. You know, how am I able to suppress my anger? How am I able to manage my time? How am I able to overlook this? How am I able to be strict when it comes to this issue? How am I able to be flexible when it comes to this issue? You know, managing my affairs. And this doesn't happen overnight. We need to put some effort. We need to put some work. We need to invest in all of this. And the best form of investment is in the books of this like. We know that, you know, when it does come to our family, they are our priorities in our lives. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Ya ayyuhalladhina amanu qu anfusakum wa ahlikum. Wiqaya means safeguard. O you who believe, safeguard yourself, protect yourself and your family members. Alaykum anfusakum. Take care of yourself. Make sure that you tend to your matters and you tend to the matters of your family.
Ayatollah Jawadi Amuli, the author of the book Mafatih Al Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatihul Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc. But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree.
امام همونطوری که این رو گفته بارم گفته دی اون امامی که گفته اگر روزه بگیری ثواب داره همون امام گفته که اگر درخت بکاری اون ثواب داره.
امام has mentioned both of these subjects. The very imam who has stressed out the reward for praying has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree.
محیط زیست نگه سالم نگه داره این دقیق ثواب داره.
There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment.
وقتی میخوای کشاورزی کنی یه قدری گندم بگیر رو به قبله بیست این دعا رو بخون این هم همون امام گفته دیگه.
When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very imam has mentioned.
تو نظام اسلامی این جلد دوم جاش خالی.
We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alihi, he is always reminding us, Ya Ali, he says, Ya Ali, khidmatul iyal kafaratun lil kaba'ir. If you were to serve your family, it's a form of atonement for major sins. And in a long, very beautiful hadith that speaks about khidmatul iyal, serving your family, serving your wife, and serving your children. And another hadith, He says, وَسَلِّمْ فِي بَيْتِكَ يَزِيدُ اللَّهُ فِي بَرَكَتِكَ. Say salam in the house, when you're walking inside your room, in the room, when you're entering into the house, you say your salam, and it will increase.